Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. Great talks. And this session is about bucket trials and umbrella protocols. We all know the concept of targeted therapies and personalized medicine is not new to us. We are not here to describe what they are. We really are just want to discuss to see how to make it better. The oncology field has changed a lot. We have very good drugs, I want to say, since maybe around 2000, last 15 years, a lot of drugs approved. Many of them are targeted agents. We have small molecules. We have antibodies. We have antibody-drug conjugates. Recently, we have bispecific, bi-targeting products. When the T cells are activated against specific antigen, tumor antigens. So really the field has changed a lot. We have many good drugs approved. And is there a way that we can use these drugs to make the personalized medicine even more personalized than ever? And not just approved drugs, but also drugs that are currently being developed as we speak today. We have great panelists with us today. I had the great pleasure of working with many of them, or actually maybe all of them, directly or indirectly. A little bit about myself. I was at the FDA, a supervisory pharmacologist. I was at the FDA for about 12 years. I just a few months ago separated from the FDA to become a consultant. So starting from that end, I'm just going to mention their names, but I will ask each speaker to talk a little bit more and give a little bit of background about what they do and where they are right now. So Mark is at the FDA. We have Eric from Novartis, Jim from the NCI, Pat from Yale University, and Ellen from Friends of Cancer Research. So starting from that end, Mark, could you please introduce yourself?
Sure. So my name is Mark Thierry. I'm a medical oncologist and a lead medical officer for the melanoma sarcoma team in the Office of Hematology and Oncology Products. I've been at the agency now since 2009. And one of my other roles at FDA is as the scientific liaison for melanoma. So this involves essentially outreach, interacting with various groups, trying to further development of drugs for patients with melanoma.
Yes, hi, I'm Eric Schlossberg. I'm at Novartis Oncology. I'm a senior director of translational medicine there, and so I work with our early phase clinical team on our phase one and proof of concept studies, as well as leading an initiative in the U.S., a series of basket protocols called a signature program, which is we can talk about it a bit more later, but a tissue agnostic, mutation specific, point of service clinical trial program.
Hi, I'm Jim Dorshow. I'm the deputy director of the National Cancer Institute and also the director of the Division of Cancer Treatment and Diagnosis. And in those roles, I oversee NCI's drug development program.
I'm Pat LaRusso. I'm a medical oncologist at Yale University. I'm the associate center director there for innovative medicine, trying to increase integration of science and medicine in developing their, enhancing their early therapeutics program.
I'm Ellen Siegel, Chair of Friends of Cancer Research, political oncologist. And I mean that seriously. Chair public-private partnerships for the Foundation for NIH. I vice chair the Reagan Udall Foundation at the FDA, and I'm on the PCORI Board of Governors.
Thank you all. If you could have the slides up for the points of discussions, please. And we would like to make this highly interactive. If you've been involved in such trials and if you have suggestions to improve some of these, if you face some issues, problems, bumps on the road, please feel free to discuss. We would like to make it interactive as much as we can. So one of the potential issues that I could see is the collaboration, and it was pointed actually this morning also, how is MD Anderson partnershiping with other folks that are perhaps doing the same type of trials. So two things that came to my mind. One was that if different institutes are conducting the studies and they're coming up with data, would it be nice for all of them to share all these data? So hopefully we can use it for the next trials and sort of stop reinventing the wheels. If we have the data, perhaps we can share them. And also, there are very good drugs out there, and not all of them are approved. And if we are recognizing recognizing that not all drugs are available, is there a way that different pharmaceutical companies could partner with each other and use each other's drug? And we'll go through the list, but before we start this, I'm sure all of you know about umbrella trials and bucket trials, but perhaps it would be nice to give just a little bit background, and I would like Mark to start by giving a little bit background about such trials and the initiatives.
Sure, thank you. So I'll keep this brief as you requested. You know, essentially the umbrella and bucket trials or basket trials, you know, has really come about based upon the fact that the single drug, single test, all-comers clinical trial is not sustainable moving forward in the genomic era of medicine. You know, as we heard from a session on pediatrics yesterday, Dr. Peter Adamson, head of Children's Oncology Group, essentially, you know, mentioned the fact that all of their cancers are rare cancers. And that's really the way with genomic medicine that adult oncology is going as well. So in terms of just brief definitions of what an umbrella trial is, a basket trial, so an umbrella trial allows the evaluation to test the impact of different drugs on different mutations in a single cancer type. So, you know, essentially if you think about the umbrella as the cancer type, for example, lung cancer, and then the various different mutations with different drugs or combinations of drugs to test within that mutation. Whereas a basket trial is looking at a single drug or combination to basically evaluate for activity on a single type of mutation or mutation class in various diseases. So the basket or buckets being the different disease types from that perspective. And I just want to say that the FDA has actively endorsed and supported and vocalized its support for these types of new clinical trial initiatives to really further cancer drug development for patients. So I look forward to the discussion with the panel this morning.
And is everybody familiar with the MATCH trial and signature trials? If not, perhaps we can... Okay, so I see some people saying no. So perhaps we can have some introduction into those trials, please.
So could I run through my slides? Would that be okay?
Sure.
Because it would address it specifically. So if I could, if you could go to my slides... So the second slide really is go to the next slide. I'd just like to say a word before we get started, because there was lots of publicity about the Precision Medicine, Precision Oncology initiative that President Obama kicked off about 3-4 weeks ago. And just for those of you who don't know some of the details, this is a request in the 2016 federal budget for an additional about $210 million a year for 5 years. To support clinical trials and a cohort of patients that will develop, in essence, bucket and basket trials across a wide spectrum of diseases and for a wide range of patients. In particular, there will be, if the monies are appropriated next year, additional funds to deepen the range of studies that the NCI will be able to support to analyze mutations and other molecular characteristics at a greater level to develop better models for those diseases from biopsies taken from those patients, and actually then to further develop a public database of all of that genomic information. So if we go to the next slide, just to reiterate what you already know, but I think it's probably important to realize that While it's very, it seems clear in the community what a bucket trial is. So that is to say, you have a drug and you're going after a specific mutation, irrespective of the disease entity. I think there are different ways to do so-called umbrella trials. They can be either disease-specific or non-disease specific, and go after a particular drug and mutational profile in either of those fashions. Ellen, I think, will tell us about the LungMap trial, which is one type of umbrella trial. I'll talk about, in very briefly, about MATCH, which is a different kind of umbrella trial, and Pat will as well. But also, you need to understand that those trials can be randomized or non-randomized. Those are the randomized trials are few. One is the NCI MPAC trial, but that they also bring us to the point of trying to, what level of evidence and interest and outcome are we trying to establish? And finally, an important point on this slide is to realize that, and I'll make that point in another slide as well, that one can run these trials either using a defined algorithm that basically says that if you have a particular allele frequency, if you have a particular mutation, you get a particular drug or drug combination, or that can be done in the context of an expert panel. Next slide. There are advantages and disadvantages to all of these approaches. To me, one of the biggest advantages of trying to do these kinds of things is that, at least for the NCI, it allows us to provide investigational agents to a wide range of clinical situations. We have a large number of partners in the community, not just in academic sites, and doing these studies really, although it is, I'll say in a minute, a significant challenge, is also, I think, has a remarkable public benefit in terms of allowing these tests to get done irrespective of the insurance status of a patient, and to allow individuals in communities across the U.S. to participate in this type of molecular oncologic approach. Next slide. So really what I would like to just point out, because I think this is really a slide for the discussion for the entire group, are the challenges of doing some of these kinds of studies. I don't think in my entire career I've ever participated in any single study that is more challenging than the MATCH study, and there are literally hundreds of people who have participated for over 2 years in trying to develop this study, including my colleague Barb Connolly, who's in the audience, who oversees it from the NCI's perspective. But just the notion of assembling a pharmacopoeia, in this case of now 20-plus companies with more than that number of drugs, and the IP rights that would allow you to do an umbrella trial across, which is a whole series of sub-studies underneath an umbrella that is histology non-specific, the IND issues and the oversight regulatory issues, both from a central IRB, are just nothing short of astonishing in terms of what we have overcome, and I think are ready to roll out, or hopefully will be ready to roll out around the time of ASCO. If you think about it, it's much more difficult than running the National Cooperative Group System, because we are not distributing drugs by study, but by patient. And so if there are 3,000, 4,000, however number of patients that get enrolled ultimately on the MATCH trial, we have to rapidly not only obtain the tissue, do the assay across multiple laboratories, a small number but still multiple, get the data back to the practicing physician, and then get the drug shipped for that one patient in that one practice. A remarkable a feat that I think we will be able to pull off, but not inconsequential. The tissue acquisition issues themselves, I think, are worth making a short mention about, because while it might now be standard of practice to do these kinds of research biopsies in our academic sites that participate in these kinds of trials, it's certainly not standard of practice across all histologies to do fresh tissue biopsies in patients in the community. And then the ability to centrally process those tissues to do it in a quality way, perform the assay, and then get the data into a completely new database that has been established by ECOG Akron in consultation with the NCI has also been a major effort. I think lastly, but not inconsequentially, again, the sites, there are so many sites that will be over 2,400 participating in this trial, have to be adequately prepared, again, because they've not done these kinds of investigations. And there's a lot of patient education as well as investigator education. And finally, I'd like to say a word that while one tries to put these studies together, we are constantly dealing with the fact that the standard of care changes. And so, as I think Ellen will talk about, you can have a major arm of a trial that over the course of the 6-8 months of establishing that sub-study in your umbrella now becomes FDA approved. And then the trial has to be either amended or the arm dropped. And so this is an enormous opportunity. Next slide, last slide. But I think it's one that, although this schema, I think, looks deceptively simple, it looks actually amazingly simple, it is unbelievably complex. I think that one of the major things that we will get out of conducting this study, we will undoubtedly get some signals that will be able to be followed up with additional disease-specific studies. But I think the most important thing that we will get out of doing this is actually learning how to do such a study like this, which has never really been attempted at this scale.
Thank you, Jim. And I believe, Ellen, you have some slides to share?
Yes. So thank you for this opportunity. I think you all know the problems with clinical trials and certainly genomic trials. It is important to note in the LungMap trial that the idea came from Rick Pazdur. When we did our Friends Brookings conference, we always go to FDA and NIH and ask them what they're interested in. And Rick said he was interested in a master protocol specifically for lung cancer, and the reason was obvious. These one-off trials will never accrue, will never get information, will never advance the field. So the concept came. And, you know, one of the outstanding really issues when you look at the complexity of trials is that one trial is over 36 administrative functions. It's just almost impossible. So that's really important to note. The investigators, the key investigators here are Roy Herbst from Yale, and I have to say his name 5 times or he won't be happy, and Vali Papa, which I can never get her name right, so anyway, so please, if anyone asks Roy, tell him I said his name 5 times. What is absent from this are the partners. I did this quickly because I really want to talk to you about the lessons learned and really some of the issues and challenges of this trial. But what's absent here are Amgen, AZ, MedImmune, Genentech, Pfizer are the partners, and with support from Novartis. This trial is $175 million, $25 million coming from the NCI, and the rest of the money coming from the other partners. A very complex trial with lots of partners and lots of inputs. The setting is second-line therapy for squamous cell, non-small cell. We have a very elaborate process for how we choose the targets, the drug selection, lots of committees. What's also, I think, really important to note from concept, from when we did our Friends Brookings conference 2 years ago to execution where we had the trial ready to go was less than a year. So that was pretty amazing and a lot of hard work by a lot of people. Now, we know the benefits of these trials, efficacy, efficiency, access, consistency. This trial is very cost-effective. It's about $35,000 per patient. It has next-gen sequencing. It has a foundation platform in it, predictability. And the most important part, I think, for patients is there's an arm for every patient. So you are screened, and then we have a non-match arm on it, which makes it very, very attractive for patients. So it's an important model. It's efficient. It's cost-efficient, and it's predictable, and it's something that should be very attractive for patients. So what are the lessons learned? That's the hard part of it, because when you are doing, this is essentially a public-private partnership. This has multiple partners, and theoretically, no one is in charge and everyone is in charge. You absolutely need to understand that culture has to change if you're going to do it. It is not an entitlement for cooperative groups to get the money and do what they want. It is not for FDA, they have to be flexible and have been flexible. For NCI, they have to be flexible. If it is business as usual, the way everybody operates, these trials are not attractive. You have to change culture. You have to understand. You have to be flexible. And you have to understand this is a partnership. You cannot say this is the way we do it. And everybody has to change, and the companies as well. So this is a really big cultural change. And collaboration means, partnership means that no one is really actually in charge. There are certainly standards that everyone, NCI, FDA, companies have to go through. But at the end, you have to understand this is about the patient. The patient has to be the North Star on it. And accrual. If these trials do not accrue, if they do as usual, then they will not be successful. This model works when you are up and accruing and you're beating the standard. We know we have problems with accrual on all of our trials, and spending, it doesn't organically happen. When you launch a trial, we're open now at 500 sites. And accrual is challenging. We're getting there, but culturally you have to change and you have to focus. Flexibility is incredibly important. Science changes. We have the novolumab approval, which was great news, but that meant we immediately had to change one of our arms of our trial. We had problems with another arm. We had to change. We are now looking at creating some other feeder trials. We're looking at single-arm trials. This has to be flexible, adaptable, and everyone has to really understand that this is for the benefit of the patient, and culture has to change if these trials are going to be successful.
Thank you, Ellen. And I believe, Eric, you have some slides to share
as well?
Yeah,
thank you. You can get them up. I think that the challenge we face is real. And the percentage of patients that go on clinical studies in the U.S., as Ellen showed, 4%. I've heard estimates much less than that. And these result in time delays for us. It results in delays in patients ultimately getting treatment, ultimately getting benefit. And the reasons for this are many, but clearly, the vast majority of oncologists in the U.S. do not participate in clinical trials. There are a ton of work for the sites. They take forever. It's a lot of negotiation, a lot of back and forth. Consenting patients, and these days with molecular pre-screening, often doesn't even lead to them getting onto a study. The biopsies just, the tissue just disappears, tissue fatigue. And so this is a, you know, it's a highly wasteful, expensive process. So what can we do, you know, to address this? And I think the efforts that Jim and Ellen are leading these, you know, Herculean tasks to move these studies forward, but really, you know, should be applauded for doing this. And that's what we're all trying to do. And at Novartis, we came up with, you know, I guess a pharma approach to address this, which is very similar. It's a series of basket studies that are tissue agnostic, mutation specific. So if you have a mutation relevant to a particular compound that's in the program, you could enter any tumor type, solid or hemalignancy. And we're not pre-selecting sites. So we're waiting for the patient in Iowa who doesn't, you know, get some molecular profiling. They have a PI3 kinase mutation, a PIK3CA mutation. They don't want to go to Houston. They don't want to go to Boston. But they want to get a novel therapy. So we wait, if this is a research-capable site, for them to call us. We have a dedicated phone line. We'll go. We'll deliver them a centrally IRB-approved protocol. We have an approach of, we will not negotiate on the budget and contract. So we present them with the package. If they want to get the patient sitting next to them on the study, they can. They sign the forms. We get them open. We found on average that this takes 6 weeks, as opposed to our internal average, I think, consistent with the industry, roughly 35 weeks to get clinical sites open. So this has vastly sped up the time. It's eliminated all the wasteful back and forth. You know, we have teams of lawyers and contract negotiators who sit there all day, go back and forth on petty things. You know, we're paying, you know, as high as we can under the OIG guidance, you know, to be consistent with what we can, but fair market value. So again, if you follow the process, I mean, the patient goes, right now there's routine molecular profiling being done, local labs, foundation, night diagnostics, et cetera. They're getting this done, and then, again, I mean, this just walks through the whole process. So, and the study schema, I mean, I won't really go through this, but it's a signal-finding study. We're not tailoring this for pivotal. We're not taking this to the FDA to get registered. We're looking for early signals so that we can then turn to our colleagues and our full development team and say, you know, we've accrued 20 patients with, FGFR mutant anal cancer, you know, and we're getting high response rate, go do a pivotal study. And we have a very novel adaptive Bayesian statistical design that really powers us for, you know, so with 10 to 15 patients, we could either declare futility or efficacy. And so this program's been open for about 2 years. We have 8 protocols that have been open. These data are a bit outdated, but across that time, we now have 450 patients dosed. And you can see the geographic spread. You know, it's all across the U.S. We have multiple sites. This is mainly tailored toward community practices, but, you know, we're open to everybody. Academia is clearly a key partner for us. They're obviously doing a lot of molecular pre-screening. MD Anderson was the first academic center to get this open, to our amazement, to their amazement, you know. But we have now, I think, 15 academic centers participating in this as well. So this can be done. It really, you know, we see this as approaching some of the key issues that we have here. And non-enrolling sites, which are another key delay, right? We don't have any, because you have to have the patient sitting there next to you in order to get this protocol open. So I think it's a, you know, very novel approach that we've taken, really aligned with what you guys are doing, and a key challenge to get this approved internally in Novartis and externally. But, you know, I think you could really advance things via this. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. Pat, would you like to share some background and your experience?
Yes, I apologize. I don't have slides, but I can talk this through. So we have essentially an investigator-initiated umbrella trial that was funded in part by Stand Up to Cancer and Melanoma Research Alliance. It is focused on one tumor subtype only, which is non-BRAF mutant metastatic melanoma, and it is, like I said, an investigator-initiated trial. So we don't have the luxury of the masses of people that are working on these trials, either the MATCH trial, the LungMAP trial, the SIGNATURE trial. It's essentially a trial that I've spearheaded with a small group of my own people. And so that in itself has had many, many challenges. So what we wanted to do, what we set out to do when we started this trial and were funded to do it, was partially funded to do it, was to see whether or not a personalized medicine approach to this, relatively not a tumor type that really at the time that we started had no therapeutic intervention to speak of that was meaningful, would be better than standard of care, which was, you know, your chemotherapies, your IL-2. And so basically it has morphed over time because immunotherapy has become the mainstay or the standard of care for essentially all melanomas. And so we have altered our inclusion-exclusion criteria. Obviously, patients had to have progressed on immunotherapy. And then one of the things that we do, which is unique to, I think, all of the other basket trials or umbrella trials, is we're using extensive sequencing in the form of whole genome, whole exome, and RNA-seq compiled together with a turnaround time of about 14 to 18 days to get that data. Every patient has to be biopsied so that we're looking at real-time biopsy. And we're not only doing extensive sequencing, but we're matching it with proteomics, circulating tumor DNA, and we're attempting to develop PDX models on every patient. We have extremely limited funding relative to any of these other projects, and we're just now starting to open it up at the sites. When we started this, we had to do a pilot trial, which was actually highly suggested by the FDA, just looking at validation of our device. And subsequent to that, now we're going into the therapeutic trial. But we had to bring the companies together on our own, which was not an insignificant feat, and then identify the sites and contract them, and now subsequently, hopefully within the next 2 to 3 weeks, we will be starting to open up those sites. So I can tell you from a personal perspective how labor-intensive these trials are.
Thank you very much, Pat. Actually, that's great to hear, because sometimes when you initiate, you start, you hear more about the bumps on the road. When you have all the luxury of all the funding and you have all the drugs available to you, you don't feel it that much. But when you're starting and you don't have that much funding, then you know what the issues are. So thank you all for the introduction. Audience, before we go into the actual discussions, any clarifying points about these trials? I think it really needs to be clear to everybody to be able to follow all the discussions. Okay, so I guess it's clear to all. So perhaps we can now move on to the discussion. The first point that we wanted to discuss that we actually heard a little bit about is the collaboration. How do we bring all these good drugs, potentially good candidates? So we're not just talking about those that are approved, but those that are being developed and there's a good potential for them to be used in patients, and they do not necessarily belong all to the same pharmaceutical company. So it really needs collaboration among different, it needs partnership. How do we, has this been an issue? How do we overcome that? And the other part is the data that is being generated, is there any way we can share the data? So I would like to hear from the panelists their experience, their suggestion. I open it to all.
I'll start a little bit. It was relatively easy, although not very easy. The interesting part of the LungMap trial is that it was a registration trial. That made it very attractive for companies. Had it not been, I think it would have been harder. It was still challenging, but they were happy with the model. It has to be something they can't do on their own. All parties have to benefit from it. So when you do these things, if you can do it individually with your own control on your own, there's not an advantage. There has to be an advantage of accrual, getting sites up and open, cost. There has to be something in it for all parties, and that includes the NCI and patients to go on these trials. But in our case, it certainly helped a lot by having it registration quality.
You've had a lot of different companies.
Right. I mean, I certainly agree with that. It's although in Novartis we do collaborate with other companies on clinical trials, you know, it's not always straightforward, not always easy. Some of the points mentioned earlier today, I mean, who controls, you know, the study? Ultimately, where does it lead? How are you going to price that? How are you going to formulate it? How are you going to market it? I mean, these are real challenges. As Alan said, if there's a clear advantage to get a company involved, they will. I know working with Pat on her stent to cancer MRA melanoma protocol, there are some key things that we had to pay attention to keep in firewalling the data, keeping everything separate, you know, that we could get all the data on our patients, but none of the data on other patients, even so that, you know, each arm wasn't compared against the other, so that we didn't feel threatened. You know, our teams didn't feel threatened. Oh, no, you know, our drug will look worse. It was really, you know, we wanted to collaborate. We wanted to advance the science. But, you know, as Alan said, I mean, teams, pharma, everybody needs to feel that they're getting something out of it and that their interests are being protected in one way or the other. And, I mean, I have no idea how, you know, NCI match with 30-odd companies. And I know, you know, we're... one of them that early discussions, I mean, that's a very hard thing to do, and clearly I don't know how you manage it.
So I have one extraordinarily hardworking tech transfer lawyer whose office is next to mine. And I would say that without that individual, and Barb's laughing, right, who's had, I would say, infinity minus one number of phone calls with pharma companies that we would never have gone forward. He's a great person, but really, you can laugh. But the truth is, we launched discussions with pharma at ASCO 2013. Right? Okay. So it's not 2 years. We are still having phone calls with new companies who want to initiate arms in MATCH because there is no. I wouldn't say it was unlimited because my budget's not unlimited, but the fact is, interesting compounds, we have actually probably more companies still lining up to want to participate. This is all being done under a single IND, an NCI-held IND. That probably makes it much clearer because there are rules and IP considerations that have been well established. The government doesn't want any of this IP. That helps. As you just heard, the umbrella is set up so that there are a series of phase two trials with investigational agents with known phase two doses that the data will all be public, but there will be no comparisons. That clear, we would never have gotten the drugs if we had said that when published, the studies would be compared one to another, and even to the extent that there will be sub-trials of multiple drugs with the same ostensible mechanism of action, but perhaps other reasons to try one versus another, and those will not be compared. But I think that the level of time, interaction, to allow this to happen, which of course we quote in quote, only want the drug from the companies. We're not asking for any financial contribution. That helps, but still, there are the regulatory issues not to be undersold. But I think, actually, it may well turn out that trying to put together this pharmacopoeia may be one of the signature achievements that's already occurred in developing this trial.
Thank you, Jim.
There's a question out there.
Please.
So I'll direct this to Jim, but maybe others can comment. Yesterday, a strong case was made that to see dramatic effects, or perhaps even to see a signal, you need to block all the pathways that might be mutated in a given tumor. So I don't know the details in the MATCH trial, or as the rest of the panelists think about this, how do you start to test all the permutations when you have a single drug that might be ideal for the given target that you know your drug is going on, but you need to block the others to even see what effect it might have?
So these studies, whether it's MATCH or MPACT, whatever, basically we go with initially the mutation that is the highest frequency. When patients progress, they have the opportunity to be treated with another agent if there's another appropriate agent that is matched to another mutation. So that actually, or be biopsied at progression and go on to another, so that you could actually go through multiple, beyond multiple sub-studies within the umbrella based on an individual mutation. It's also clear that, activity is ongoing, some of these sub-studies will be combination trials that are appropriate to a multiplicity of mutations that are detected.
But, you know, they're not always that easy to put together in combination. So although you recognize that, you know, you have, you know, an NRAS mutant melanoma that also has a CDK, mutation or molecular aberration, the challenge is although you recognize that there's multiple mutations or amplifications, it's hard to put those drugs together because of overlap and toxicity. So it's not that easy unless you want to dummy down the doses, and then you don't know if you dummy down the doses too much whether or not you're hitting those targets. So those challenges do exist. I'm sure they have, you know, their magnitude is a lot greater because they're working with a lot of different tumor types. But even in melanoma, we've been waiting for a MEC-CDK combination so that we could include it into our trial. But the challenges have been companies being purchased by other companies or whatever the legal issues are, overlap in drug toxicity, so that it's been very challenging to move that combination forward currently, although we're hoping that, you know, those things will be ironed out and we can incorporate it. But it isn't as easy as just adding drugs together, even if you can get every drug company to work together.
So now that we are on this topic, it's really the last bullet point here. Multiple targets are identified in the same tumor. Which one do you target? Which one? Is this the one that is the most sensitive, and this is in the single-agent therapy part of it? Or what do you do? How do you make that decision which mutation, which marker is the most sensitive and driving the tumor phenotype? And the other part is that when you have multiple drugs available for the same target, how do you go ahead in selecting the drug? Is this because it's available, is on the market? Is it because the drug is a multi-kinase inhibitor and can attack multiple different proteins at the same time, all involved in the progression of the disease? How is that decision done? Can you expand on this?
Excuse me, we have a couple of questions from here. Is that okay?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Apologies. Yeah. I have a question. Naomi Rosa from Novartis. I have a question specifically for Mark with regards to the histology agnostic clinical trials. When you have multiple indications, for instance, 7, 9, 10 indications within a specific mutation or alteration, what is the threshold from a regulatory perspective if you have activity or compelling activity in X number of indications or tumor types, what is the threshold to get like the blanket approval from a regulatory perspective if there's one?
And this be recorded.
Exactly. So, you know, there's no answer to what is that threshold. to be realistic. You know, the considerations are obviously, you know, the disease, the available therapies for that disease, you know, in terms of unmet medical needs versus not. You know, the design of these lend itself very well for home runs regarding, you know, rare diseases, actionable mutations with a great scientific basis, you know, for activity, you know, of a particular drug on that mutation target. But there is regulatory precedent, you know, that can be looked at. So specifically with the imatinib trial, there was approvals in essentially four different rare tumor indications based on one trial, which was looking at essentially over 40 different tumor subtypes with a particular mutation class or actionable mutations based on the drug, in which case, based on the rarity of the tumor, the lack of available therapies, the activity did support new indications. That activity was essentially based upon objective response rates in each essentially single-arm trials and the duration of response supporting that objective response rate. Also dependent, this depends upon the amount of information that's known about that particular drug or drug combination. You know, if there's a lot of safety and efficacy already described for a particular drug, that will weigh into decision, you know, making process.
I'll just add on to that. Just to plug, I think the FDA has been very flexible and workable on this and open to conversations. And I know that everolimus was approved, gained an indication based on a 27-patient pediatric study in tubular sclerosis, and that was actually an investigator-initiated trial. So really, you know, quite flexible, quite amazing. I think when the data is stark and there, you know, we're able to make progress on it.
So, and to put it, that's a good point. To put some numbers, you know, on the imatinib trial, which led to the approval, you know, within each bucket or basket, you know, so to speak, the number of patients, you know, was not necessarily that high, 20, 30, and was actually supported by literature, you know, reports, so depending on the, you know, the evidence. So there is certainly flexibility, you know, there with the realization, you know, these rare cancers, you're not going to be able to do, you know, randomized controlled clinical trials, you know, when there's no, you know, effective, you know, therapies for accrual. So, you know, it, from the regulatory landscape, you know, it does have the patient population, the available therapies, you know, play a big part into, you know, what are the regulatory paths, accelerated approval, you know, traditional approval. So it really depends. So we encourage that conversation to occur very early on, you know, when these trials are being developed in concept.
More questions we have from the audience? Yes, please.
Yeah, yesterday we had a very nice panel on immune oncology, and we realized the complexity that we're facing right now by combining immune oncology with targeted therapeutics. And interesting, two of the indications that you mentioned in your trials are very successfully treated with immune oncology. So how do you deal with that changing landscape? From my perspective, it looks like a good opportunity to actually test some of the hypotheses in the clinic, combining immune oncology with targeted therapeutics. How difficult is it for you to integrate this kind of combinations?
Well, in LungMap, we had the non-matched arm with a metamune, or PD-L1. It was very attractive, is still attractive. We are now looking at combinations very quickly, so we're looking at multiple combinations, and we're going to graduate into that very quickly. We do have a drug selection committee process. We have a rigorous process that we go through, but I think we believe, and the investigators believe, the combination will be our next step. We are currently changing the protocol based on what happened with nivolumab to a single arm in, until we can get to the combination, which we think we'll get to this summer.
Coming from the FDA, we never made that decision for the company what drug to combine with what other drug. So the decision was always the sponsors based on whatever the studies they conducted, proof of concept, literature available. Somebody else did a combination and a similar or same indication, and they got good results, and that sort of triggered another sponsor to come up with the same combo of drugs, but it was usually based on what the sponsors decided based on the best available data that they had. Mark, would you like to add something to it?
No, I agree, you know, with what you said.
Well, the you mentioned precedent for drug approval based upon some of these smaller basket trials. I'm wondering if there's also precedent for companion diagnostic approval as we're going into these studies. We're going to need to have biomarkers that we're testing in parallel.
Certainly. So you know, the companion diagnostic issue is a very important issue when thinking about these master protocols, umbrella bucket trials. You know, we do encourage not only early consultation with the drug division, or if it's a biologic, the Center for Biologics, but also early consultation, you know, with the Center for Devices and Radiological Health. They have a mechanism for what we call QSUB or pre-submission opportunities to discuss the pathways. And that's why in all of these expansion, or not, master protocols, the regulatory intent, having a very clear regulatory intent, really facilitates that communication. Obviously, with, you know, from the investigator perspective to the company, but also at the FDA level, so that we can provide, you know, the advice, the best advice that we can based on the available information.
I mean, to me, the you know, it's a really important issue, and I think when you look at, for example, lung cancer now, you know, the patient theoretically, with the marketed and companion diagnostics in trials, they would have to get their tissue tested for EGFR and then ALK and then, you know, PD-L1 and then NRAS, you know, and then c-MET, and there's no tissue left, right? And I think we really need a coherent approach to this, ideally something that where we could have panels fully approved, you know, and free from any particular drugs in a robust manner, so that we could just get, you know, the one little bit of tissue done, tested for 200 things at once, and kind of be done with it. Because companion diagnostics, I know for us, you know, they're very difficult, they're very time-consuming, they really cause delays, and I don't think anybody wants that. And, you know, we just don't have the tissue available. They're just, it's really not very workable these days, so.
For LungMap, we chose the foundation platform through a competitive process, and we had extensive discussions with CDRH prior to the trial opening, and they were very comfortable with that. But we did go through a competitive process.
Any other panelists would like to add to it with based on experience? So based on my experience, if you don't know where to submit your package to, and if this is early in your drug development, you submit it, and let's say this is a drug developed under CDER, you submit it to the division in charge of the review of the drug, and the division will invite folks from CDRH to attend internal meeting, and then you receive the guidance, and then you can go on to have separate meetings with CDRH for your in vitro diagnostics.
You know, you had mentioned immunotherapy, I think it was you. You know, it's not only combining immunotherapy, but I think equally importantly, and I think there's a lot that we're going to learn from these studies, is sequencing with immunotherapy and what the opportunities potentially can be there. So I think that as we're developing these studies, you know, trying to, one of the things that I think is going to come out of a lot of these studies is the information, I think, that we're going to gain in terms of the genomics, the proteomics of the tumor, but also what are the immune, you know, marker, what is happening in terms of alteration in immunotherapy, you know, in the microenvironment, and how is sequencing these drugs going to be important, and can we then restimulate so that we can maybe go from immune therapy to targeted therapy to immune therapy again? Or, you know, is the response to a MEK inhibitor after immune therapy going to be any those are the kind of things I think that we're going to learn from that. I mean, we realize in our tumor type that, you know, immuno-oncology and melanoma is extremely important. And although we don't have the money to look at it in our trial, we're trying to partner with someone right now who has access to those type of diagnostics that can help us better understand the disease.
Any more questions from the audience? Yes, please. You have a question there.
I'd be interested in the FDA's response to the comment from Eric, where Eric noted that it would be helpful if we moved away from companion diagnostics towards something more comprehensive. The FDA is now looking at approval pathways for panels. Clearly, they could bring a lot of efficiency. So where's the FDA's thinking on giving Eric what it is he wants?
Interesting. Mark, this
easy,
is the question.
Easy question. So I can't answer that question, you know, being from the drugs division. Obviously, we all recognize the challenges, you know, here with the single drug, single test model, and, you know, there's discussions, you know, surrounding that, you know, in the public forum, certainly, you know, from a, you know, moving away from that perspective, but also the challenges of the diagnostic tests that are already here or may be coming in terms of what is the pathologist going to do, you know, when they select a specific test, you know, if there's various types of tests for different drugs, you know, with different thresholds potentially of what's considered positivity, you know, how is that going to impact, you know, the treating oncologist? So there's multiple challenges, and clearly, you know, we do recognize that, but you know, I can't speak to that point specifically.
Let me try to speak to it. Let me say things you perhaps can't say that I can't say. First of all, there is a guidance that is ready to go, and it should be released, and I don't know why it's not being released, but it should be released because this is a big issue, and there's a lot of opposition from the community on this. These things have to be regulated, or they have to have platforms that we understand that are standardized. I have absolutely no idea whether the MSK platform or the Mass General platform or the UCSF platform or, frankly, the MD Anderson platform measures the same thing. There has to be some standardization of this because these are guiding treatment and they're being used in practice every single day. There was a huge conference at the NIH 2 weeks ago about this, and everyone believed and agreed to the fact that there has to be some evidentiary standards. So this guidance needs to be released. Probably 100 patient groups signed a letter to the FDA asking them to release this, and for some information, it is a very big deal.
Thank you. Anybody else would like to comment on issues around in vitro diagnostics? Any issues interacting with the FDA that you faced? Also related to this, the methods to detect mutations. If we're hoping that one day we'll have and share all this database, do we want to think about what methods we're using to detect the mutations, and we're all standardizing that? Eric pointed to the size of the tumor and tumor biopsies. So is that part of the inclusion-exclusion criteria? Because tumors are not always homogeneous. They could be heterogeneous, so how many biopsies do you want to do? Is the size of a tumor something that you take into account when you enter a patient to a trial?
So I think my point was more related to the heterogeneity of tumors, right? And if you look at not just one tumor within the tumor, but within the tumor compared to its mets, and also chronologically. I mean, oftentimes we're, you know, letting patients in based on a biopsy that was 10 years old. And that may be relevant or may be completely disparate from what the patient's tumor type is now. And I think we saw some data on that yesterday. So, you know, and this is just a challenge that we've got to do. I mean, ideally, what we all want is a fresh biopsy the day before you get in the study. I mean, that's in multiple places. And maybe circulating tumor DNA or circulating free DNA are ways to address that. I don't know how validated those approaches are just yet. I think there's still a bit of a way to go, but I think that's the direction we need. I don't know what others think about that. But.
Any comments, questions related to these, what we discussed so far? No. Okay, so I think we discussed the this point of multiple targets identified in the same tumor. And if you're thinking about combination therapy, it's easier. But if you're thinking about single agent therapy, then what goes beyond the decision making of what drug to use? Is this the mutation that is most sensitive? Is this because of what you have available, what drug is available? And I don't know, I mean, for the clinical trial, the price may not be an issue, but thinking ahead for the registration, Is that something that the group thinks of, the price eventually when it gets approved, the price of a drug?
Well, let's not all talk at once.
Yeah.
Well, you're the reigning clinician here.
Yeah. So I'm the reigning. Yeah, you're the patient advocate, and I'm the reigning clinician. I think this is
what the patients want is what works.
Yes.
That's what they want. They want things. Of course, affordability and this whole range of pricing is a big issue. But a drug that is cheap that doesn't work is not what a patient wants. They want the right drug for them, and they want some efficacy for it. And if we do that, I believe we'll save a lot of money, but more importantly, we'll save patients' lives.
And, you know, working isn't always tumor regression, but it's prolongation of survival and it's overall survival advantage. You know, patients want to live. That's why they're treated. And I think it's our job to try to figure out which of those drugs is going to give them the greatest probability. Now, when you're running into multiple different drugs with affecting the same target, you also have to look at promiscuity of that drug. What are the toxicities of that drug for patients relative to the promiscuity of that drug? Is it a select targeted drug, or is it a dirty drug affecting multiple different targets? You know, and if you're going to look at it in combination, you also have to look at the kinetics of the drug and the variability of the half-life, you know, when you're combining these drugs relative to the other drugs for overlap and toxicity and resolution of toxicity. There are a lot of factors that go into it. Now, once the drug becomes FDA approved, competing with other drugs of the same class, you know, there are many different antihypertensives that, you know, have the same mechanism, albeit in oncology, as we're developing these drugs. You know, we're narrowing many times the patient population based on the genome, the molecular signature of their tumor. But, you know, those are all things that have to be taken into consideration. It's much easier to, you know, have a financial gain when you're first in class and you're going to get to the market first, as opposed to the seventh MEK inhibitor or the seventh RAF inhibitor. I mean, that's something pharma would have to answer more than me, because, you know, I'm a clinical trialist that
it's
wants to.
It's actually good to hear that. It's really what I'm hearing is the outcome.
Yes.
What you see in terms of efficacy and safety that pushes what gets selected. Eric, did you want to comment?
Well, I'll
Jim?
I mean, just, you know, Linda showed a slide before, right? When you have the right target, the right patient, the right drug, things work. And I think there are, you know, multiple cases of that, and those are beautiful drugs, and that's what we all want. The problem is that there aren't that many of those drugs, right? And most of the drugs work a little bit. They, you know, they do a little bit. They're good. They're better than nothing, hopefully, right? Certainly the FDA keeps us honest on that. But and the challenge is we have an information vacuum also. We don't really know when you have multiple mutations in a particular patient. Sometimes it's clear, but sometimes you don't know which is better. And I know on the signature protocol, we've had multiple patients come up that could have gone into one, two, or three protocols. You know, and we try to look at the preclinical data, and we scratch our heads, and, you know, we shrug, and we say, well, you know, you can go sequentially from one to the next. But these are hard decisions to make, mm-hmm. and not clear.
Yeah, so I just like to underscore that, because I can't go into the details why, but I think there is a perception, certainly, and a concern I have about what is out there, not only in the advocacy community and also in the patient community, and also in perhaps some parts of the oncology community, where I think people have bought this Kool-Aid that this actually is proven to work, and yet what we're all talking about are really first steps. Yeah, in this approach, we will learn over the course of the coming decade actually how to do these trials. But if they're either portrayed to patients or they're portrayed to the media that we know the answers, that's wrong, and it leads to it will lead to a lot of dissatisfaction with early failures.
Thank you.
I just want to echo that, because patients are vulnerable. They trust their oncologists. They often don't have second opinions, and getting data that really is important to them is really urgent. And also quality of life, PRO metrics are really important, because if you have a survival of 3 months, your quality of life really matters.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and one of the other things is, you know, some of these agents, you know, we're starting to redefine maybe where they fit in as we you know, we developed drugs maybe 10, 15 years ago that we thought were dogs that were semi-targeted agents, and come to find out now, you know, as we understand more about the biology of the disease and about drug combinations, they're resurfacing as potentially good indications. I mean, I think at ASCO's plenary session last year, the ovarian study with cedarinib and olaparib was pretty interesting, because I worked on cedarinib as a clinical investigator and really got not too far with it. But I don't know if that data will pan out in a randomized phase 3 study. But as we're starting to understand more about the biology of the disease, some of these agents will possibly resurface. And don't you have a repurposing granting mechanism that I just sat on?
So let me say a word about cedarinib, because this is a great story. And anyone, if there's anyone in the audience from AZ, I don't mean to be pejorative in any way. But basically, we did a study of cedarinib for alveolar soft part sarcoma, an incredibly uncommon, it's 200 cases a year. And it turned out that cedarinib is the first effective systemic therapy with a 40%, 45% response rate in that disease, which you could only study at the NIH because we flew people in from all over the world to participate. But AZ was not especially interested in trying to get approval for a drug for 200 patients a year, and so we got agreement from the FDA to do a randomized phase 2 for a potential indication, and they agreed to supply drug. And about halfway through, that study is about a year ago now, basically the supply that had been was more than sufficient for that trial, but they were done. They were done with cedarinib, and we basically spent about 6 months. We negotiated an agreement with AstraZeneca to just ship, instead of putting however many kilograms of drug they had, you know, somewhere in Bayonne, New Jersey, you know, in a repository or wherever, to just ship it to the NCI repository, and we would use it for rare disease. And that was before the randomized phase 2 from the Farber got all the press. Literally minutes after that presentation, I got an email from a tech transfer lawyer at AstraZeneca. They had shipped, 100 kilograms or whatever was left and all of the supply to us. And they basically asked us, could we please not, we had a signed agreement. It was now the government's drug. Would we please, as fast as possible, send them all the bulk drug back, cancel the agreement so they could pursue, because that's what happens, right? I mean, this is exactly what happens. That's a true story.
And did you?
Yes, we did. We did, actually.
Good.
Any comments on that? Okay, what about rare mutations? We keep hearing about actionable mutations, and many of these are common mutations. What about those very small number of patients with rare mutations, assuming that there is a drug out there to treat those patients, and how difficult it is to recruit and find those mutations, recruit those patients with those rare mutations. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can talk a little bit about that on the LungMap trial, because many of our mutations are rare. We're going to add a PARP line to it this summer. I think it's 5%, although now we think it may be higher. Some of our mutations are 4% or 5%. When you do these bucket trials, you screen everyone, and it's a lot easier to do it than if you're doing it on a one-off, particularly when you're open in many, many sites. That is an advantage. If you wanted to do that site by site by site, by the time you have to screen hundreds of patients to find five patients, it's not very efficient.
Thank you.
I think this is a real challenge. So I think when you have rare cancers, where you go to your oncologist, wherever they are, and they're identified as a rare cancer, that's okay, because then you could be referred to, maybe that oncologist doesn't have a trial open, but they could refer you to a place that does. But when you have a rare mutation that's silent, that can only be picked up if you're screening, to me, this is something that kind of kills our drugs. It delays things so much, because when we have to, consent 20 or 50 patients to get their tumors sent to a lab in Basel for us to screen it, to find the one with a mutation, by the time that 20th patient comes around at the site and they've got zero, they're batting zero, right? That nurse, that study coordinator, they do not want to consent another patient. They are tired. They're sick of it. And so we get sites that just give up all the time. And sometimes, you know, they get the one patient's great, and then, you know, their AST's off, their liver's enzymes are off, and they can't even, you know, get the drug. So it's very discouraging. It's very hard. It takes forever. And that's why, again, you know, I like this kind of panel approach where we could have, you know, some way of capturing these patients locally at sites and, you know, finding and discovering these rare mutations and somehow, you know, feeding them onto a study. I think that's really important.
Thank you.
Because these patients do benefit, right? I mean, even with ALK inhibitors, 4%. I mean, mm-hmm. those studies got done because lung cancer was doing a lot of screening and because those drugs worked really mm-hmm. well. So mm-hmm. patients were willing, you know, the sites were willing to do it to save that one person. But for most of them, it's really hard.
Mm-hmm. You know, even in rare tumors, I mean, we have to really identify what the mutations are even in those rare tumors. But even if there are studies that you can refer a patient to, it's very difficult to get the patient to the site. Because, you know, you just don't go there. It's not one-stop shopping, and you go there once and you're done. And, you know, I've been very, very blessed over the years in that I've been able to work closely with the NCI. The one advantage that they have is that they can move patients to their site, especially if there is a rare tumor trial. And I think there's another funding mechanism that was just put forth to hopefully improve upon that mechanism in those rare tumors that may have these, you know, rare mutations for which the patients do have real diseases, but it's difficult to treat them because you can't get them to those sites. I mean, I think there are multiple advantages as we're going into this era of genomic medicine to partner with places such as the NCI to increase your access for the patients to be treated and to work through that mechanism, mm-hmm. at least as a clinical investigator.
Right, right.
And I'm not saying that because Jim's sitting next to me. I'm saying that because your patients can benefit significantly.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Also, another point is that sometimes we're dealing with very small number of patients, and then we're adding arms. Sometimes we're switching patients from one arm to another arm. How could this possibly make the registration not so easy, let's put it this way. So, like, in a match trial, my understanding is that a patient could potentially be switched from one arm to another arm, so the patient is receiving not just one drug, but multiple drugs.
Right, but remember, that's not a registration trial.
Yeah. Right, but how does that, is that a hypothesis generating?
Yes.
But if you have such small, like, rare tumors, and you're dealing with rare indications, how this could potentially lead to a registration trial, considering that you will have very small number of patients and you can't use this as a registration trial. So what are the hurdles?
So the plans are as follows. So we expect if we do the 2-to-1 accrual as expected, you know, in each of these umbrellas, if we get a couple of responses, we'll be happy. Right, and anything that is signal generating within the context of the umbrella can be followed up under that umbrella with a larger number, basically a phase 2 study of the specific mutation that for which we got a signal. Right, so we will follow up. That still won't be a registration trial, most likely, but at least we have a mechanism because, as you might guess, there are more than a few groups, advocacy groups, that want their own match trial. There's going to be a review in a week or two of something called Euromatch. And I don't mean with an E. I mean with a U. U-R-O match, okay? And there are, we've been, I'll just say there are many communities that are interested in saying it will be much easier, I believe, to do some of the pilot work if we get signals in the context of this IND that we've already established, rather than setting up an entire new process, an entire new IND for each individual disease. Subsequently, if randomized phase 2s have to be done, then clearly those will have to be independent of the overall match trial.
Eric, do you also see all these as hypothesis generating and with a follow-up for a registration trial? And do you see any issues around registration trial with small number of patients, or do you think this is something that could be done, easily done, feasible?
So the signature program was set up as signal finding, as hypothesis generating. That's our intent. You know, as we get, if we get positive data to warrant a pivotal study, you know, and let's say it is a potentially very rare indication, then the question is how do we do that? And we are now looking at incorporating our model into a more standard registration, you know, study, the registration trial approach, with, again, not pre-selecting sites, just going out to ones that, that find these. So that's something we're working on in Novartis, and we hope to have. We may start with a phase two or a phase one and not a pivotal study, but we are trying to mold that model.
And Mark, do you see any issues, problems
I was going to say, so from the FDA perspective, you know, we really want to get safe and effective drugs out to patients as quickly as possible. We do have different mechanisms to do that, one of which is an accelerated approval process for which drugs which have not necessarily comparative data, but even single-arm data, meaning just that, you know, patient population receiving the drug, can lead to a registration and an approval through the accelerated approval process based on, for example, objective response rates. So for patient populations for which there is no available therapies, has a high unmet medical need, you know, we have used this pathway very frequently to make these drugs available to patients. For example, the last two approvals in melanoma were based upon objective response rates in essentially single-arm, you know, evaluation of single-arm data.
Now, I want to add that on LungMap, the FDA has been incredibly flexible and, in fact, has encouraged us not to have every arm with the same standard and to look at single arms for the purpose of registration. It is possible, and we're re-looking at what we're doing now. And if you do it properly, it can go to accelerated approval. You know, the theory is you can't, but you can.
Thank you. Any comments, questions? We have a question. Yes.
Yeah, so if you're taking the single target, single drug and multiple indication type of approach, and assuming you have already gone through the exploratory stage and you see enough signal and you're in the process of designing your pivotal trial, and assuming, you know, different indication, do have standard care, even though standard care doesn't work that well, but different indication have different standard care. So in a situation like that, how you approach the question whether or not you need a randomized trial, and if you need a randomized trial, how you design the control arm?
Is that addressed to Mark or myself?
I think the whole panel. Yeah.
I mean, clearly it's a challenge. You know, these bucket and or basket umbrella trials are, to my eyes, they're signal generating. And when you get into the confirmatory stage, I think we have to revert, for now anyway, back to the more classical design with, well-controlled randomized versus standard comparator arm and not mixing in too much. The LungMap does have, right, these multiple comparator arms that are unique in each one, as I recall. And so I think that is... that is very nice and advanced in the field.
But we're changing, and we have to get protocols that patients actually want to accrue on. And if the standard of care, you know, the nivolumab approval on our immunotherapy arm, really, who wants to randomize on that arm, right? I mean, we have to think
they
about
want it already.
You know, this has to be. What the patients want, and frankly, not only what the patients want, because sometimes they are confused and there's a lot of data coming at them, but what's really right for them?
Right.
What's really right for the patient? I would not randomize on that arm, and I don't think anyone in this room would. So we're looking at that, we're changing that, and we're having a lot of encouragement from the FDA and NCI to relook at this model. But if you are going to randomize, and no one wants to ever suggest that a randomized trial is not the gold standard, but in these very, very rare tumor types, it may not be feasible. But if you're going to randomize, you should absolutely understand that standard of care is right for the patient, and what you're randomizing to gives the patient some benefit.
Great questions. More questions? Take advantage of this opportunity. Any more issues you would like to discuss related to these types of trials?
So can I ask you a question, Jim? So if you're in the MATCH trial and you identify a hit with a specific tumor type and a specific drug, does the company have the opportunity to run with that data and move forward clinically, or is that data under the NCI and the NCI will make the decision as to whether or not they want to move forward with that trial?
Well,
do you see what I'm asking?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think probably that's a win-win.
The
data will all be shared. It'll be public, but it'll be shared with the companies. If the companies want to go forward, that's great. If we want to go forward, and we'll go forward.
So
I think that, remember, this is going to be, the data will be as transparent as possible.
Maybe a question for the panel. One of the things we presume, you know, most of these studies is that we know that, you know, molecular preselection of patients is going to result with that patient getting a better therapy, right? If you have a FGFR mutation, you should get an FGFR inhibitor. Or if you have a PI3 kinase mutation, you should get a PI3 kinase inhibitor, and then maybe we'll randomize versus standard care there. And I think, Pat, in your study, you're addressing this, but, you know, what's being done to really address whether that fundamental underlying principle is true? You know, is molecular preselection actually better than getting chemo or nivolumab, whatever it may be? And I think, you know, we all think, of course, it has to be, but I think it would be really important for us to do that study. It'll help gain justification for reimbursement for, you know, these panels for these tests. It'll help maybe, you know, work with the FDA to advance it. And I think that's a very important thing to do. Again, anytime we all assume something is the case is when we're wrong.
Right.
And so I'm just wondering what's being done that front.
So there is a trial that started a year ago at the NCI and is going to be expanded very soon, I hope, to all of our phase one and two sites. It's called the MPAC trial. It's basically that. It's a randomized trial of treat me now versus treat me later with the matched therapy versus treatment with the drugs on the same list that are not matched.
Oh, good. Well, thank you.
And, you know, I know with our trial, the non-V600 or the non-BRAF mutant patients, we got a lot of flack from a couple investigators that we do have a randomized trial. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is we do not yet know. We don't know relative to response, survival, or toxicity. And I still think that although we are still randomized and we're one of the few that is randomized, we do have a crossover arm. But because we don't know, I think that it still is a legitimate thing to look at because of the amount of investment that we're putting into these trials, mm-hmm. whether or not this approach is the best approach. I think, I think Jim and everybody has said, there's a huge learning curve with these trials right now.
Right.
And there's a lot that we are getting out of it. And not only, you know, there's operational issues, there's response issues, there's what does the underlying profile of the tumor look like relative to those exceptional responders within the context of each of these arms. So I think that there, you know, we just can't narrow and put our blinds on and just think that the only thing we're looking for is efficacy relative to therapeutic intervention.
And is there anything you want Mark to do at this point? He can take your message back to the FDA, so this is probably the best time to discuss it indirectly with the FDA, and that would be the last point, and I think the time is up.
I have two messages for Mark. Get the guidance out. It's not in drugs. It's in CDRH, and you guys are doing a great job. Jim, I do have a question for you, though. As we are, when you're trying this new trial, who's going to accrue on it? Are patients really going to want to accrue on that trial?
The MATCH trial?
No, not the MATCH. The MATCH trial is a totally different. Yeah, the IMPACT trial.
We have had no problem because it's if you explain to the patient that actually the equipoise is, we don't know whether they're going to benefit. And we specifically exclude patients for whom there is actually proof.
Okay.
Yes, we only take patients for which there's no data.
Right. And just to be clear, the patients get the data at the end, so the second line they could still get the targeted?
Okay. Yeah.
Great.
Okay, I think our time is up. Thank you all, and thank you to the panelists. Great discussion. Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you to all of you for participating.